You're listening to the Hayek Program Podcast. This podcast includes audio from lectures, interviews, and discussions from scholars and visitors of the F.A. Hayek Program for Advanced Study in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at the Mercatus Center at George Mason University. To learn more about the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. To learn about graduate student fellowship opportunities with the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org.
Today is Monday, December 8th, 2025, and I am here with Professor David Beto. Dave and I are old friends back from IHS days and everything, and Dave has a new book out on FDR, and we're going to have a conversation about it. So, Dave, thanks for coming on here.
I really appreciate the opportunity to come on.
All right. So my first question is sort of also sometimes a concluding question, which is FDR is often considered one of the truly great presidents by historians. You're a historian. For example, in the 2024 Presidential Greatness Project, he is ranked second after Lincoln. And given your detailed examination of FDR's life and politics, what examples of his actions are, in your opinion, provide the biggest challenge to this historian's consensus? And given the deep history that you do, why do you think it persists in the historical record, this idea of his greatness?
Yeah, I think his days of those kinds of rankings will be passing soon. And I compare him to Woodrow Wilson, because only about 10, 15 years ago, Wilson was ranked as one of the greats, one of the top presidents. But people started to look more closely at his record. A lot of people looked at his record on race, on the left and the right. They looked at his record on foreign policy, and they said, this is not greatness. This is worse than that. This is setting up for a lot of problems that occurred later. I don't know. It's a rich target list with Roosevelt. If you look, you know, the longest depression in American history, double-digit unemployment, that's quite an accomplishment at the end of the 1930s. In fact, I often say that if Roosevelt had, in fact, not run for a third term, as he said he didn't want a third term, and many people expected him to step down, how would historians rank him now? They would look at this record. They would say, well, he's still at double-digit unemployment. They would look at his record on anti-lynching legislation, for example. Though there was public outrage about lynching, you know, there was all sorts of opportunities. He did nothing. They would look at his record on providing a refuge for refugees that are starting to flow in from Europe. And they would say, that's not a good record. So they would look at all sorts of examples like that. And I think, you know, you have FDR, the wartime president, and that kind of saved him, right? Everybody likes a winner. And I think that that helped to boost his rankings. But even when you include that, in fact, when you include that, you find all sorts of negatives. Very poor civil liberties record. I argue is actually worse on civil liberties than Woodrow Wilson. Woodrow Wilson gets bashed a lot, I think, with some justice. But I would say Roosevelt's attitudes towards civil liberties is much more intolerant than Wilson's. Trouble is, for FDR's standpoint, is they had some institutional breaks on his ability to limit civil liberties. But his attitude was, I think, even more intolerant than Wilson's. So that's a small list.
Yeah, we'll come back to the issue of institutional breaks, because I think that's very important. But I wanted to follow up on this, because one of the things when you walk into the Holocaust Museum in D.C., one of the first things when you turn, you know, that you walk in and you see the pile, at least the last time I was there, you see the pile of shoes, you know, and everything. And then you walk, and then eventually you're going to see this little display, and it's about Roosevelt sending back refugees rather than allowing them safe harbor in New York, sending the ship back to Europe. Can you discuss a little bit about this issue of attitudes that he had towards others, let's say, in general?
Yeah, we often look back on World War II and we see the Holocaust as a prime motivator, right? We had to fight the war against Hitler because of the Holocaust. Well, you got to put yourselves in the minds of people like Roosevelt and Churchill. Now, they didn't like Hitler. They thought he was kind of a gangster, and they thought this guy's out of control and all that. But the persecution of the Jews at the beginning of the war, when the decisions were made, and I don't think I'm very controversial in saying this, that really wasn't, you know, at the top of the considerations. Roosevelt's was an anti-Semite, right? People, you know, I compare him to H.L. Mencken. People say H.L. Mencken was an anti-Semite. When you actually look at it, H.L. Mencken's views on Jews, Jewish refugees, was a world apart from Roosevelt, much, much more tolerant. And so Roosevelt was kind of a country club anti-Semite when he'd been at, which made him more insensitive. He was on the board of overseers at Harvard in the 1920s, and he pushed for a quota system, unsuccessfully, by the way. But he was in that group of the overseers that wanted a pretty severe quota system. Now, that isn't just his attitude in the 20s. In the 1940s, he is still defending his record as Harvard Board of Overseer. So you have opportunities to help Jewish refugees that are starting to come in the late 30s, and he drops the ball repeatedly. He just isn't interested. A lot of people say, well, he had a lot of Jewish advisors. Well, so did Nixon. In fact, I think Nixon had more Jewish advisors as a percentage. So that's not necessarily a good indication. So he had certainly an appreciation for the talents of these advisors, but he kept them somewhat at arm's length. And there was a kind of insensitivity there that I think is well documented by other historians other than me.
Yeah. Let's go back to Roosevelt's kind of intellectual origin story here, because you start there as well, and you talk about the influences in his education on the German historical school and the social gospel movement. If you could give some examples of those, discuss what those mean actually to people, because I think those are removed in many ways from people's mental models nowadays about what we think about. But that kind of idea of what imbues him, I think in your discussion, you referred to it as basically progressivism without any limits in some sense.
Yeah, Roosevelt is influenced. Let's sort of step back for a second, though, and say Roosevelt is no great intellectual. And people commented on the fact that this guy didn't read books, right? He was more interested in collecting stamps, and he would spend hours on that, yachting. He was interested in pursuits like that. He was not a great student. He was a mediocre student. He was not that intellectually curious. However, he is influenced by these ideas, by progressivism. And I always say Roosevelt is not an intellectual, but ideas matter to him. He's an ideological default on the progressive side. Now, he'll back off if it's going to interfere with winning an election, but that's where he comes down on. So what's going on at the time that young Roosevelt is going to Groton and to Harvard? Well, you have intellectual ferment. You have a lot of American professors are returning from Germany to get their graduate education. A lot of them went there because it was cheap to study there, and they highly developed a graduate system. And they imbued the ideas that they're taught by the so-called socialists of the chair, who are loyal to the German Bismarck regime, who believe in a strong government, government intervention, zoning laws, social security, government pensions, kind of a rigorous military policy as well. And so those ideas are out there. He has influenced them. He is early on, not later, but he early on is very much an admirer of the German system. He said they've discovered a new kind of liberty. Our old view of liberty is rather impoverished, and they have a newer view. So he's very influenced by that. He's also very influenced by two men who are influenced by that as well. So he gets a second hand. One of them is his very distant cousin, Theodore, who he often refers to as Uncle Theodore or Uncle Ted. And technically, I guess he does become his uncle in some sense when he marries Eleanor, because Eleanor is Theodore Roosevelt's niece. Franklin is something like sixth, seventh cousin, very distant, but they know each other. They move in the same circles and that kind of thing. So he's influenced by Roosevelt. And Roosevelt's view, Teddy Roosevelt's view, is very much focused on the ends. Meaning, you have a problem, you need to solve that problem. Don't worry so much about the procedures, the process by which you get there. So, for example, the Bill of Rights is something, you know, don't get bogged down in these precedents, in these restrictions, if you've got something. He is very influenced by Wilson. And Wilson and Teddy don't get along, but Roosevelt gets along with both of them. He is an early supporter of Woodrow Wilson. And he leverages that into a position in the Wilson administration, Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And from Wilson, he gets a lot of his sort of rhetorical ideas. Wilson talks a lot about democracy and human rights in very much an abstract sense. And we see Roosevelt picking up on that stream. So he kind of melds these two together in some interesting ways. And Wilson, of course, and Teddy Roosevelt are very influenced by other trends that are going on. You mentioned the German influence, but also there is the social gospel influence, which is very big during this period, which is kind of this view that you can bring in a kind of earthly kingdom of God on earth. Murray Rothbard used to call it the KGE. And I think Murray had a good point there. These ideas are very influential, and these are Christians, but they believe that you can bring in the millennium in a certain sense by improving earthly institutions, right? You can eliminate poverty, you can eliminate war, you can do all these things. So there's a strong view that things are malleable. And Roosevelt, I think, secondhand, he's not that religious a guy, but I think secondhand through these other sources, he's influenced by that as well.
Yeah, just a little aside for a minute, which is that, you know, Rothbard had very strong interpretive frame for the progressive era, right? And he had this whole idea, again, about going to Germany and that these were basically Presbyterians who had a certain view about eschatology. And then they were educated over there and they were post-millennial pietists, so they came back. And, you know, one of the things that's interesting about it is many of it was concentrated, and not so much in Harvard, you know, where we're talking about, but actually in Wisconsin, at least in economics, you know, the whole economics department there was very much grounded in this kind of approach. Richard Ely, who's the founder of the American Economic Association, was actually a major social gospel guy and pushing this. There's
And Ely, by the way, was very had direct influence on Teddy Roosevelt.
Yeah.
I mean, Roosevelt said he made me sane in my economics. He taught me economics and made me sane in my economics.
Yeah. Have you, you know, I'm sure you've looked at it, but Thomas Leonard has this fantastic book on the progressives called The Illiberal Reformers.
Excellent book. And I cite it. It's good
stuff.
Yeah.
And it flips everything in everyone's sort of mythology, going back to the earlier part. It flips this mythology quite around. You know, Herbert Crowley, I think that's his name, wrote The Promise of American Life.
Yes.
And that was also a majorly influential, he was an influential journalist and then also author in this regard. Is that a correct interpretation of this?
Yeah, and Crowley, this ends means issue is very important with Crowley. He made the argument that, well, Hamilton was right about government. You need strong government to get things done. But Hamilton was wrong because he wasn't for equality and he was an aristocrat. So Jefferson was right on that. Now, we can differ with the interpretation of Jefferson and Hamilton. But basically, Crowley's argument was Teddy Roosevelt is great because, I guess Wilson in some sense too, because he uses Hamiltonian means, meaning big government, to advance Jeffersonian ends, meaning equality and democracy, right? And I think Roosevelt, you know, in kind of diluted way, kind of saw himself that way, but I say highly diluted. He's not a great intellectual by any means. I doubt he read Promise of American Life. He would have gotten this stuff secondhand, but he got it.
Let me go on to my next question, which is, you know, it's well known that free market people are not a fan of FDR. And many leftist revisionists are not a fan of FDR because, as you pointed out earlier, is racism and abuse of power. But you're a historian and you're like a really great scholar. And so in many ways, I'm not saying you don't have a point of view, but you're doing history and you transcend a lot of these ideological pigeonholes because you're beyond, you know, pro-market or, you know, pro-civil liberties. You're sort of seeing these things in together. You know, how would you discuss and detail some of FDR's examples where it's an assault on individual rights in both the commercial sector and in their personal lives?
Well, I mean,
I mean, I know the whole entire book is on this, but so maybe just a couple good examples.
These things are, I mean, I think it's fair to say that these things are interconnected. And this is where the historians of the left and to some extent the right kind of make a mistake. There's a general mindset here, right? There's an opportunism. There's a mindset that government is the way to go. Bigger government is the way to go. Well, some examples of Roosevelt's views, and I guess this intersects on both issues in some ways, is view towards mass surveillance. And Roosevelt really is kind of the father of the mass surveillance state, but not in the ways that historians have traditionally said. A lot of historians will look at J. Edgar Hoover, who was certainly around during that period, and, you know, the FBI and the origins of the CIA and so forth. But they forget something that's called the Black Committee, which is a U.S. committee, Senate committee, led by an economic progressive named Hugo Black, who later becomes on the Supreme Court, kind of a populist type, kind of a Bernie guy, but a loyal New Dealer in a way. And Black wants to discredit people that have opposed some of Roosevelt's New Deal reforms, including his economic regulations. So he wants to target these people who he believes are just part of the big business cabal. And so he brings them in to question them before his committee. And they fight back, and often effectively fight back against him. So Black has the smart idea, or somebody has the idea, and Black runs with it. And that is, what if I could get these people's, these targets, these witnesses that I'm going to grill, what if I could get their private communications? What is the leading kind of private communication during the period? Telegrams. Over 50% of long-distance communication is through the private telegram. They're instantaneous in many ways. People say things in telegrams that they wouldn't say in letters. They're very similar to emails and texts, very close parallels. And this is extremely important form of communication. So he figures, look, if I can get these private telegrams of these people, I can ambush them. I can get what they really think, and I can hold them up to scrutiny. And I can, you know, literally ambush them because they won't know I have this stuff. And so what he does is he goes to Western Union. There's just a story about that the other day. Western Union and remittance is sent by foreigners, and how the federal government is trying to get control of that. Well, what's old is new again. At this time, Black went to Western Union, which had copies of all telegrams. So they had to keep copies of them, right? And he said, I want all telegrams sent to and from every member of Congress. He just started with this for like a 9-month period. You know, I want every single telegram. And then he starts to, you know, get more ambitious. And Western Union's response to this is, are you kidding? We're not going to cooperate with that. Our customers will not appreciate that. You know, they think we're providing privacy. He goes to them, they refuse. And Black goes to essentially Roosevelt, federal government, and gets the FCC to agree. And the FCC orders Western Union to cooperate. So Black and his committee staffers go into Western Union, and they start looking through these big stacks of private telegrams, thousands a day over a long period. He looks at millions of private telegrams. Black gives his assistants said, well, if you see anything private nature, such as between husband and wife, just look past that. But if you see anything related to lobbying, that was his committee, was focused on lobbying, then you will copy that. You will note that. How would he define lobbying? Any attempt to influence public opinion. So what we're doing is lobbying. Indirect or direct attempts. So it doesn't have to be you're talking to members of Congress or anything. It could be you're trying to influence the general, it's like the Interstate Commerce Clause, right? You know, it'll have a general effect, right, on the world of ideas. In fact, I think that's not a bad comparison. And so you can do any kind of, you know, if it involves shaping opinion, you can control it. And again, Black, to just go back, has a Senate committee that is investigating lobbying, but defined broadly. He gets copies of these private telegrams, and he starts ambushing witnesses who do not know that he has the telegrams. Eventually, Western Union fights back by starting to inform people. that your telegrams have been seized by Senator Black's committee, and they start fighting back and they bring lawsuits, and it becomes a major controversy. This is headline news in the Washington Post and the New York Times. It is condemned widely on both the left and the right. And though Black is able to get these telegrams, courts, federal courts, put limits on the ability of future committees to do this kind of thing eventually. So there is a backlash against it.
So this is another example of your means ends issue that you were talking about. I want to ask you a little bit about ends, because part of the revelations in the book is, for example, the use of espionage and sedition acts by Roosevelt when he was young to try to engage in explicit racism, and then also to attack homosexuals, sailors, right, to target them. What was the end that, right? I mean, we understand the means. He's trying to eliminate, you know, through the power of the state, but what is the end that he's doing with regard to targeting of minorities and of you know, homosexuals?
Well, first of all, Roosevelt's an opportunist. He wants to advance politically. You always have to remember that. Now, that's not all he is, right? So I'm not one that says that's all he is. He has ideas and he wants to advance those, but he wants to advance FDR. And we could go through the list. During World War I, Roosevelt was very sensitive about this. His uncle Ted, cousin Ted, had resigned as Assistant Secretary of the Navy to not go on a ship, right? But actually lead in an infantry unit. Right? He'd gone right into the middle of it. And he was about the same age as Franklin was when Franklin was Assistant Secretary of the Navy. And Teddy wanted Roosevelt, FDR, to do the same. He urged him to. Franklin did not. And he got Wilson and he got his boss to say, well, it's essential. We need him as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. Of course, Teddy had ignored that kind of advice and then gone ahead anyway. Franklin was not going to do that. So he was not in uniform during World War I. He was very sensitive about that. And there was this guy who was kind of a quasi-anarchist, had a little newsletter that implied that there was something funny about this. Why isn't he in uniform? Just implied it. Roosevelt wrote to the district attorney in Atlanta and said, why isn't this guy behind bars? He needs to go into federal penitentiary. And the district attorney, you know, under the Espionage Act or whatever it would have been, the Sedition Act, there's various things you could have used. And the guy writes back, said, well, I'm sorry, sir, we don't have a case against him, right? That's not enough, even in World War I. Roosevelt on gays, and this is how I start the book, because I think it's actually quite a significant turning point in a lot of ways in Roosevelt's life. And it's called the Newport Sex Scandal. And this is where Roosevelt is Assistant Secretary of the Navy, and he volunteers to help out a guy that's sort of informally doing this investigation of gays in the Navy, same-sex relationships, trying to expose them and drum them out of the Navy. And it's a low-level investigation, and Roosevelt, it's kind of withering on the vine, but Roosevelt finds out about it and says, I'll back you. Not only that, he heads a unit called the Section A, in the Department of Navy to investigate, to oversee the investigation of same-sex relationships in the Navy. This unit starts using methods of entrapment to entrap sailors. And what do I mean by that? When I saw it, I couldn't believe it. You know, they actually go and have same-sex relationships. The investigators will have same-sex relationships with, you know, people to expose them, to drum them out. And, you know, they're defended by their bosses who say, well, you got to get it done. You got to get the job done. And so that's what they do. Now, you would think that's pretty bad, but you think, well, you know, people's attitudes towards gays are, you know, not like they are today. But even then, this is very, very controversial. Investigations are opened up, including by a U.S. Senate committee who finds Roosevelt at fault, said Roosevelt denied he knew about these methods, but nobody believed him. And said, he is responsible. He is unfit for office. This is headline news in the New York Times. And Roosevelt is very much on the defensive here. But he initially, his response is, well, you know, if I have to send a ship from Newport to Cuba, I don't worry. I don't tell the captain on how to get the ship there. I just tell the captain to get the ship there. That's all I do, right? That was his initial response. So this is very, very controversial. Roosevelt is just really upset by this and ends up not really hurting him because I think other things in the news are out there. It gets pushed aside and Roosevelt sort of gets more of a sympathetic focus because only weeks after the Senate committee issues this damning report, less than weeks really, Roosevelt comes down with his paralysis. And here's an interesting link. Roosevelt blames his paralysis on this investigation. He blames the Senate committee because he said they wouldn't let him testify, you know, and they were out to get him. And how does he blame them? Well, they might have been right, because part of the argument is that he comes down with this because of tainted water and a lowered immunity, right? What could lower his immunity? Tension, lack of sleep, you know, worry, right? And that he blames this committee for this, and he might have been right. So this is the side of that that people don't often look at, but again, it's pretty well documented. Some people have picked up on it, including a very recent author of a wonderful book, Biography of Eleanor by David McCallis, who provided a nice endorsement of the book. But it's very much a big book that's out there about Eleanor Roosevelt, but has a lot on Franklin in it too. Highly recommend it. But others have looked at this, how this was part of the puzzle.
So that's in the beginning of his career as he's marching up, but he continues the assault on rights of individuals in both areas during his administration. Can you give some other examples of where Roosevelt is so willingly able to use the power of the state to sort of punish his enemies and reward his friends, let's say?
Well, I gave the Black Committee, and they're not only doing telegrams, of course, the Black Committee is looking at taxes, for example, which is controversial at the time. They're getting tax returns and they're using that. But there's a successor to the Black Committee called the Minton Committee. And Minton ends up on both Black and Minton up on the Supreme Court, frankly, because his rewards, right? That's the key reason why Black gets on the court. But the Minton Committee is doing the same methods, but they can't do private telegrams. So Minton gets very frustrated and he proposes a bill in the Senate. And frankly, I think Roosevelt suggested it. I don't have 100% proof, but I think he was certainly sympathetic to what Minton was doing. And this was a bill to make it a crime to publish any article known to be false, fake news. Roosevelt was very much worried about fake news. He said, I'm for freedom of the press, but I'm not for the ability of people to publish untruths. And that's what Minton is trying to do. Now, what's interesting about Minton's bill is it shouted down. I think it's a trial balloon. Roosevelt is asked about it, and he says, well, he's already seen that there's a negative reaction. He's saying, well, you know, if that bill were actually enacted to make it a felony to publish untrue news, you couldn't find room in the federal prisons to put all the people that would be found guilty of that crime. The reporters laugh at that. Minton, though, has to withdraw the bill because it is so unpopular on both the left and the right. He's shouted down, essentially. And Minton is not a minor senator. He's on his way up. And again, he was Roosevelt's first choice for the U.S. Supreme Court. The position went to Hugo Black. Minton turned him down because he wanted to stay in the Senate. Later, Minton had another opportunity and accepted an appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court. So those two guys were Roosevelt's two favorite senators, I think it's fair to say. Sherman Minton and Hugo Black. Hugo Black was the guy, it was said by Roosevelt's son, that father said that if he ever wanted something done, he'd go to Black. Black was a very ruthless, effective senator.
Yeah, one of the things in reading your book, I want to end with this, but I don't want to get there yet, but is that, you know, I kept on being struck by the more things change, the more they stay the same in terms of politics. But, you know, maybe we can talk about that. I wanted to talk about the two big challenges that Roosevelt faces, that the reason why people think of him, you know, in this very favorable light is because he was someone who came to power in the midst of crisis, his whole regime. You know, my dad was, you know, was not a professor or anything like that. He you know, was a soldier in World War II. He was a flyer. He flew over in Europe. He went in prisoner of war camp, all that stuff. When I was in college and I was just learning this stuff, and especially as I got interested in learning about like what Murray Rothbard had to say about everything, you know, FDR becomes like the main bane of your existence if the Great Depression is your focal point of studying economics. And my father always used to, you know, argue with me. He said, listen, you know, you don't change a horse midstream. So we had to stick with him and he was up to the challenge. And what you were just saying before is like he was facing these big challenges. So I just wanted to address this issue about FDR confronting the Great Depression with various policies called the New Deal. And I wanted if you could discuss some of the problems that you saw with his policies and their effectiveness with regard to combating the Great Depression and how those policies actually feed into this centralization of power and authority in the United States.
Well, the Roosevelt is continuing Hoover and expanding Hoover. And I think, again, Rothbard is really, there's a lot to that book, right? His book, America's Great Depression. I'm not always a fan of Rothbard, but on some things, I think he nailed it. And that was kind of one example. Hoover makes the big departure, right? Before Hoover, the attitude towards depressions is reflected by Harding, for example, as well, you know, we had overexpansion and you know, wages got too high, prices got too high, and we need to readjust. Let it happen, right? Hoover's view is, well, that's heartless, and we need to prop up wages because Hoover had the view that high wages were the cause of prosperity. You keep them up, you maintain prosperity. Roosevelt believes exactly that, but he also believes you want to prop up prices. So the big program that he brings two big programs, and they're really key to the first New Deal, and they're kind of more forgotten now when people talk about the New Deal in some ways, is the National Recovery Administration, which is the vast system of price and wage controls to force up prices, to force up wages, to limit hours, right? You know, incredible. You know, people going to jail for violating this. And the AAA, the Agricultural Adjustment Administration, the same goal, force up commodity prices, force up agricultural prices by limiting production through any means necessary. That's his big focus. Neither one of those programs works, you know, ultimately. And I think today, you know, even a lot of historians who would be on the left would really not want to defend those programs. Because the AAA, for example, led to a lot of African Americans being forced off the land, a lot of sharecroppers, a lot of ugly consequences. NRA discriminates against Black workers because it forces up wages and they're willing to work longer hours, immigrant workers and so forth, and they're punished under it. And that's pretty well recognized by a lot of people. So those would be examples where he gets right out of the boat. He's doing other kinds of policies, like on trade. Roosevelt is a kind of protectionist. And the protectionists initially in his administration are really in the driver's seat to a great extent. However, they're not alone. There are free traders in the administration, and this is a constant battle. But Roosevelt really has an opportunity at the conference, international conference, only weeks after he takes office, called the London Conference, to sit down and try to stabilize the international economic crisis, which was spinning out of control. And he blows it off. He scuttles the conference. And again, even key Roosevelt defenders like Arthur Schlesinger Jr. say that was unforgivable what he did. So from the outset, he helps to create. Now, maybe it wouldn't work. I don't know. But he does not take measures, steps to kind of stabilize the international situation. So these are some examples. And there's kind of a lot of gyrations throughout his administration. Sometimes he wants to put big business in the driver's seat. By the end of his administration, he becomes something of a kind of a trust buster. Big business is the problem. There's a lot of unpredictability. And Robert Higgs has written about this, that this unpredictability creates a kind of regime anxiety, meaning businesses don't know what to do. They don't know if investments will be secure. They're fearful of the future. So you get a kind of economic malaise set in. And as a result, unemployment and so forth remains very high. So you can look at many examples like that, that it is, you know, it is just not a very successful administration in terms of fighting the Great Depression. We're still stuck in it at the end of Roosevelt's second term.
Yeah. And I think that you mentioned early in our conversation, the idea that you had double digit unemployment even in the late 30s, right? So before the war breaks out. So the policies are not working. But again, there's a mythology that they did work. So this is a kind of a interesting puzzle to constantly think about. And even among economists, there's a puzzle, you know, in the, you know, why it is that we don't really quite understand the consequences of that. And, you know, the role that the Reconstruction Finance Corporation and the issues that were associated with that, not only in its inability to achieve what it was hoping to achieve, but also to actually unleash a lot of rent-seeking behavior and whatnot. And as you mentioned, what Higgs calls regime uncertainty in this whole period. Can you talk a little bit more about how the policies were, an argument that you make is that they ended up by cartelizing in many ways the industries rather than competitiveness?
Yeah, that's certainly what the whole point of the NRA was, right? In fact, Roosevelt under the NRA said, if you cooperate with these rules, we will suspend the antitrust laws. And there are a lot of people in Roosevelt's administration, like, I'm trying to remember the names here, Adolf Burl, and I think, I'm not sure Tugwell fits into this category, but a lot of these key brain trusters, their view is big business is not a bad thing if it's a tool, right? They're like Teddy Roosevelt was sort of that view. If they go along with the program, if they're cooperative, if they're good partners, you don't want to have this old competitive system. It's inefficient. You can't regulate things as effectively. You want to have the ability to sit down with a few people in the room and control things. And that is the whole point of the NRA. And it very much discriminates against small business. Example, there was a guy that actually went to jail. More than one guy, but one guy's name was Jacob McGitt. He was a tailor. And McGitt couldn't compete with the big shops on the main drags. So one of his selling points was that he would charge, I forget what it was, 13 cents for pressing his suit. Or I forget what the amount was. It was something like that versus 17 cents or whatever. It was something along those lines that the big people on the main drag would do. And he'd say, look, the only way I can compete is people don't even know my business is here. It's word of mouth. The only way I can compete is to charge less. But he actually went to jail because the NRA had a minimum price. You're trying to force up prices for pressing a suit. They were very specific. That's what the price is. He was under it, and that was a jail time offense. And there were many examples like that. Montgomery Wards, which is used to be, you maybe remember them. When I grew up, they were a big retailer. And Montgomery Wards was selling tires. And they were kind of anti-New Deal in a lot of ways. And they were willing to go to jail. But Montgomery Wards is this interesting ad, said, we have to raise our tire prices next week. We apologize for doing this. We don't want to do it, but the NRA has forced us to do it. So it would discriminate against everyone, but especially against small business and the small farmer. It would discriminate against people that, you know, the sharecropper. Those are the true victims of these early policies, which very much are bringing in cartelization. Roosevelt in the late 30s finds big businesses more inconvenient. He turns on them. But there's just these gyrations. And I think the advancement of Franklin D. Roosevelt is key to understanding them.
What's lost is the forgotten man, right? kind of idea. You know, it's interesting when you bring this up because it does relate to the ideas of the progressive era and the reality of the policies. And as you know, books like Gabriel Coco's The Triumph of Conservatism or James Weinstein, which were revisionist historians from the left, nevertheless identified this in this bigness. But if you go to Rothbard's narrative about the social gospel movement coming from Germany, it was to have big government, big business, and big labor cooperating with one another to be able to, basically organize the economy such that you could achieve heaven on earth. I mean, it's a very, besides Rothbard, I was very influenced by this book called Atlantic Crossings, which is also this,
another book I cite. Good book.
Yeah. So I like to pair that with the David Hackard Fisher book, which is about when the ideas of liberty cross over. And then right. So that's Albion Sea or whatever, right? That's an earlier book about, let's say, what influenced the ideas around the colonial period and the birth of liberty in the United States or in America. And then, this book, Daniel Rogers' book, which is about the spread of these ideas from Europe and the progressive era kind of idea. And I get that Roosevelt is a very pragmatic politician that is trying to push himself forward and be opportunistic. But there's a creation of an intellectual like movement that might create an Overton window, we might say, for this opportunism to go in a certain direction. So this play between ideas and opportunities, I think, is an important aspect of what's going on as well. Do you agree with that?
I agree. And let me say, you sort of brought up to mind an issue. There are choices here. And a lot of people look at the New Deal, that just had to happen, right? You got this bad economic situation and big government was occurring everywhere. And it had to happen. It was kind of inevitable. And, that's a word that I don't like. Historians should not like. Now, you've got strong tendencies, but was it inevitable? If you look at the 1932 election, Roosevelt does not run on a New Deal agenda. He uses the term the New Deal, but it's very vague as to what he's talking about. He's often attacking Hoover from the right. He's saying things like, there's a little known speech that he called the Covenant Speech. Very few people know about this speech right before the election, where he's attacking Hoover for manipulating gold prices, not honoring the gold clause for securities, that kind of thing. He's calling for massive government spending cuts. And it's not just like he's saddled with this platform. He quotes the platform often. He gives speeches and he says, I agree with this platform. But he's, again, also going after Hoover on the left, too, in a more vague way. So Roosevelt is triangulating. He used to call that with Bill Clinton. Very effective. He's got rock-ribbed conservatives. He's got H.L. Mencken, for God's sake. Not a conservative, more of a libertarian. And it's perfectly understandable why Mencken likes Roosevelt, because he's sending a message to all people. So I don't know if I really am answering your question, but we often are caught up by the intellectual spirit of the age, that we see this as kind of, this is just going to happen anyway. But you have a lot of politicians who are being very successful during the early 30s, who are pushing budget cuts, for example, who are embracing tax revolts. That's a big element. And what are people voting for in 1932? Well, they don't like Hoover, but are they voting for the New Deal? I don't see that. Roosevelt could have gone in all sorts of different directions. And he has opportunities. One of them is there were opportunities to go in a different direction than he did on the federal bank holiday that he passes over, branch banking. And this wasn't just a theory. Canada did not have a single banking failure during the Great Depression. Why? Well, the general explanation is because they allowed banks to branch across provincial lines. And you'd have, the weaker banks, the units, they wouldn't go under because they were part of a larger system. There were proposals to allow that in the United States. And it was proposed by Senator Carter Glass during the transition period before Roosevelt became president. Roosevelt must have been aware, he doesn't comment on it that I know of, the Canadian system, but he vacationed there. And during the transition period, Glass is pressing a bill to allow banks to branch like the Canadian system. Who opposes the bill? Senator Huey Long launches a filibuster. And he's not very popular in the Senate, but he's getting some publicity over it. And Roosevelt has to choose. Glass is really pissed off because Roosevelt ends up not backing him. He ends up backing Huey Long. and this bill is scuttled during the transition. And that was the kind of thing that he might have done. So I'm not one of these people that say, well, you got to put yourself, well, I am in a way. And you do put yourself in the shoes of people at the time, and you end up seeing a lot of things that indicate that there were more choices than we've often been made out to be.
Contingency is a big part of history and understanding. I started my career doing Sovietology, and there's quite a big moment, because when Gorbachev is leaving, the mayor of St. Petersburg is a very strong liberal, but then he dies of a heart attack. Instead, you get Yeltsin, kind of thing. And what if this guy would have won rather than this guy, and these all these different contingencies in history that play out. It's hard to do counterfactual history, but it's kind of an interesting exercise to do.
Well, historians do it all the time.
Yeah.
Because the assumption is, if Roosevelt had not brought in a New Deal, something bad would have happened, right? But they don't state it. But there's counterfactuals implied in historical discourse constantly. And people sort of dismiss that term. But they do it anyway, right? But they don't do it explicitly.
It's a fascinating to me that the Great Depression, the Great Depression still has such a hold over our imaginations. George Selgin just published a new book on, the Great Depression. I'm a big fan of what he does, though I think he overstates how the claim that Keynes had nothing to do with it. It is true that in a technical way, Keynes doesn't, but under consumption theorists do. And Keynes is a branch of under consumption theory. But like the advisors that you were recognizing, the brain trust, Tugwell. So maybe Roosevelt isn't as much of an ideological, fixed person, but certainly Tugwell is, and some of the other people, like, as you mentioned, Burley and Means, all of these kind of people, they have very, very strong views about the way in which the economy operates and very strong leanings towards bigger and more involved government. And that sort of feeds into his advisors. And where did they get their ideas from? But a large part of this is their macro theory, quote unquote, our theory of depressions, is that we're under consumption theorists. And so this is going to, push a certain policy thing.
Yeah, that would be my criticism of George's book as well, which I cite often. I think it's a wonderful book, and I highly recommend it. But I agree with you. This underconsumptionism, which Keynes is part of, now a more sophisticated version and all that, but it's pervasive, and it's simple, right? It's a simple idea, and people latch onto it. Well, that must be the problem. They're not buying enough stuff, right? Why aren't they buying enough stuff? People understand that. And it's a crude kind of version, but it's pervasive. And I think Roosevelt did believe that. He's not an intellectual, but those ideas are out there big time. Hoover believes it. We often don't realize that Roosevelt and Hoover were pretty friendly at one time. All right? They move in the same circles at one time. But part of the reason that they are simpatico is that they kind of agree on stuff like that.
I mean, I think one of the real messages from your discussions of the Great Depression are not only this issue of centralization and in many ways counterproductive policies that we can judge ex post, but also just the willingness to engage in political weaponization to achieve your ends. And I want to come back to that in the end, but let's go to World War II. Because that's another thing that you challenge, which is a hard thing to challenge. So you're very brave in this regard, because this is considered, right, the greatest generation. Again, the mythology of this is one of great sacrifice and great victory. And your argument in many ways suggests that the war, because of Roosevelt's strategies, was executed in a way that increased human suffering and losses and prolonged in many ways the conflict. Can you elaborate on that claim?
Two things. I mean, we could give multiple examples. One, they were interconnected policies. And what I do in this book is I bring them together. And a lot of people really haven't in the past, but they're similar. They're part of the same thing. One is unconditional surrender, which Roosevelt states at the Casablanca Conference, which is, And he misstates history too, because the term, the Confederacy did not unconditionally surrender, for example. You know, Lee's forces did not unconditionally surrender to at Appomattox. But anyway, Roosevelt has this view that we have to just do unconditional surrender. It can't be like World War I. And what does he mean by that? No negotiation. Unless it's just saying, we give up completely, you guys, you know, completely win, right? That's the only negotiation. So no halfway negotiation. And that includes Germany, Italy, and Japan. Now, I think we see negative consequences of that. For Germany, there are a lot of people trying to overthrow Hitler. And Roosevelt gives them no encouragement because he sees them as part of the problem. You know, people like von Stauffenberg, they, you know, he sees a, although von Stauffenberg was not Prussian, but anyway, he would lump them in as part of the Prussian Junker class. And these are people that are part of the problem. And, you know, big deal that they're wiped out, that they're killed. No encouragement for people like that. And von Stauffenberg and others, Menzies, their complaint was, please let up on the unconditional surrender, because our soldiers, our men will fight on to the bitter end, but we have to have some way short of that. Roosevelt will not compromise. Italy, Mussolini is overthrown after the Allies land in Sicily. He's overthrown by a group of people that basically say, look, you know, it's clear that they want to turn away from fascism, that they want a surrender. And Roosevelt comes back and said, well, surrender, fine, but we want unconditional surrender. And this drags on and on, these negotiations, for a long, long time. So long that the Germans have an opportunity to pour troops onto the Italian peninsula. And finally, when the new government in Italy does unconditionally surrender, finally, they didn't want to, it's really too late. The Germans have entrenched themselves in Italy, and we all have heard stories about how horrific that was, fighting through Italy. And again, we could look at other examples. That's one example, rigidity, right? Another example is rescue through victory. And this has been well documented, where what do you do about the evidence that's starting to appear? And Roosevelt does see this evidence, that this isn't just persecution of the Jews, they're trying to wipe them out. You know, evidence really becoming pretty clear by 1942, if not earlier. And, you know, what are we going to do about that? And there are a lot of Zionist Jewish organizations, pretty radical ones, actually, that are saying, we'll do anything to save them. There are a lot of these Axis powers, like Hungary and Romania, that are restive, that they want out of the war. They want to cut a deal. They're willing to release the Jews in those countries if we can negotiate a deal. But Roosevelt has a policy of rescue through victory, which is the only way to help the Jews behind Axis lines is victory. What is victory? Unconditional surrender. Some of the worst slaughter occurs in 1944 and 45. And some of the opportunities to save hundreds of thousands of Jews in places like Hungary and Romania are these negotiated deals, right? The Romanians are willing to, I think it's like 100,000 Jews. They say, as long as they're transported by somebody else, we'll negotiate a deal. The Vatican is, or at least the Catholic Church is willing to do it under a Vatican flag. There's no interest in this. And it drags on and on. But it's this rigidity, and it's inconsistent as well, because actually we had done things like negotiate with the Axis for relief for the Greeks. We'd negotiated a deal with the Axis to provide relief supplies to Greeks because there was starvation going on. We've done stuff like that, but there's no willingness to negotiate, even with third parties, because they're tainted in Roosevelt's view. So these two policies lead to a tremendous amount of death and destruction that were unnecessary. But Roosevelt is a rigidity. He goes on record. Stalin does not think unconditional surrender is a good idea. Neither does Churchill. They don't think it's a good idea. Eisenhower doesn't like it. But Roosevelt, he's the boss, right? And that is the policy that is pursued. And Truman has to pick up on it. Even though I think Truman ultimately had misgivings about it, he feels he can't buck that. He goes along with it.
We haven't even touched upon one of the most egregious violations of rights, which is the, you know, Japanese internment. But a lot of people know that example. So adding these other examples, I think, just shows the willingness.
Can I say one thing about that?
Yeah, go ahead. Yep.
They know about it, but the historians even today will excuse Roosevelt. And they'll do it in subtle ways. They won't defend Japanese internment. However, they will say, well, he was busy. He had a lot on his mind. And there was all this hysteria. And it was sort of like he had to do it. And I don't think that's true. And you can read the book to see why I don't think that's true. But that even there, you're going to find a kind of subtle attempt that is not believable, in my view, to sort of explain it away.
So I just wanted to end by asking you a very straightforward question, which is, you know, what is a general lesson that you hope readers walk away from with your after reading your book about presidential powers that apply not only to FDR's example, but in general, in the way that we organize our political life in the United States?
That we need strong rules against the kinds of abuses that we saw under Roosevelt and that we're seeing again under Trump. One of the things is sedition, right? Sedition laws. I mean, a few years ago, I would say, I wrote an article, I feel proud of it rather, where I say, you know, going after the J6 people on sedition trials, that's opening a can of worms because this can be used by anyone. Guess what? Trump is using it now. What do people have counter argument to that now? They were bad then, and now sedition's a problem. So that's kind of a malleable term. Sedition, espionage, terrorism. These become malleable terms. And we need to put limits on these laws. Get rid of sedition laws. Prosecute people on J6, for example, for vandalism, destruction of property, assault. You know, these are perfectly good rules. And we don't need these kinds of open-ended rules. So I think that's one thing that we see over and over again, the pattern repeating. During World War II, the communists were for sedition. The New Dealers were for sedition prosecutions of right-wingers. After the war, these same laws are used against the left. What kind of ability do they have to complain? And any have a leg to stand on? No, they don't. And a lot, I don't have that much sympathy for them in a way because where were they when it was hard to do? So I think what we need is, and this is part of the institutional issue, we need, I don't know how you do, we need to build left-right coalitions. We do see those in the 30s and 40s. We need them now even more. Left-right libertarian coalitions, people to set up, people use this term guardrails. It's kind of overused, but set up guardrails, but also try to redefine some of these grab bag things like sedition and espionage and terrorism, because there's all sorts of abuses that occur because we don't do that.
Well, thank you very much, David. The book is outstanding, and I hope you have a great readership and you know, continue to spread the word about the book through various venues like this or other you know, lectures and things like that you're doing. But congratulations, great work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Hayek Program podcast. To learn more about the research, scholars, and work of the Hayek Program, visit hayek.mercatus.org. For more information about graduate student fellowship opportunities for students at Mason as well as at universities across the globe, please visit students.mercatus.org. We hope you recommend students to our programs or consider applying yourself.